everyone, and welcome to minute 150 of The Great Escape Minute. I can't believe I've actually reached 2.5 hours of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the great 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to close out the week, once again, is Will Slater of Exploding Helicopter. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Hi, Rob. I'm Red. Let's knock this week out of the park.
Yeah, seriously. 150 episodes. Wow.
That's good going.
I've surpassed most of the minute-by-minute podcasts with the number of episodes.
You've done more episodes on one film than I have in the last 6 years of podcasting. So, you've got a phenomenal stamina, a phenomenal work rate.
Well, we'll see how people react to the whole show. Let's see how many of them actually made it to the 50th episode. Yeah, that's a separate issue. Okay, so the begins with a plane slingshotting around a castle and goes all the way till we see Colin stumbling along blindly. As we ended yesterday's minute, we had Colin and Henley still trying to get to Switzerland, which we found out was around 263 kilometers away, based on Will's excellent research of the Disney castle. What'd you say it was called again? The name of the castle?
The Neuschwanstein Castle.
There you go. Neuschwanstein Castle. Exactly.
That sounded correct to me.
Yeah, exactly. I'll just be clearing my throat. You know, it's like Spaceballs when, they give yogurt the medallion. And he just goes... you can read it? No, I'm just clearing my throat. So... basically, the plane starts by slingshotting around this castle. Now, my first question is why are they slingshotting the castle?
Yes, they're not in outer space, so that doesn't make sense.
And they're not trying to go back in time, like they tried in Star Trek, or they did in Star Trek, where you have to slingshot around the sun. But here they're slingshotting around a castle, a Disney castle, that is. Maybe there's magic there.
Maybe gravitational fields operate slightly differently there. Who knows?
Yeah. No, because, he's in a plane, so they can go higher. maybe he just said to Colin, look, there's a castle. Oops, I forgot you're blind. I don't know. Could be. We get to see the plane leisurely continuing its flight, moving up and down, and then we get a shot in the cockpit where Henley begins to notice that there's some sort of problem because things start jittering around and moving around, and then we get an outside shot of the plane beginning to take a little bit of a dive. And then we get another shot inside where, once again, trying frantically to figure out what's going on, what's the problem here. And I think this is another example of, if we're going to do a point counterpoint of proof that he doesn't know how to fly a plane.
Oh, I'd almost become convinced that Garner did know how to fly a plane, and then he throws this, monkey in the wrench, right at the last moment.
Yeah, you never know here. Don't know. Well, and we never will know. The magic of movies, what can I tell you? the plane starts going down a little bit. We get to see shots of the plane much lower, close to a lake, which, again, beautifully shot. The music here changes into a very suspenseful music.
Such a great composer.
They do a great job of switching the music. And then Blythe seems to notice that something's wrong. It took him a few seconds to figure out that, that these jittering movements in the plane are not supposed to happen. And then he says to Henley, what is it, the petrol? And his response is very interesting because he says, I don't know. And then he says, we're losing power. And then after that, he says something about a fuel pump or a carburetor or something. I mean, it's very unclear exactly what he's saying. And even in the subtitles, it's cut out. They don't mention what he says here.
He's just sort of gabbling, listing things, and it's not. It's just sort of blurting stuff out. It's not clear what he's saying here. But
yeah,
I mean, one thing I picked up on here in this minute was I felt that Donald Pleasance takes a little too long to pick up that something's wrong. I kind of think that even if you're blind, just through sound and just through like almost the atmosphere in the cockpit, you can tell when people don't necessarily always say something. You can just sort of, you have that sort of sixth sense that that's the atmosphere has changed here. And I don't know, I just feel Donald Pleasance looks we know something's wrong, but Donald Pleasance looks slightly gormless.
Yes.
At the events that are going on for just a fraction too long. And again,
a fraction too long, for 20 seconds too long. Again, we're at the 20, he mentioned something at the 24 second mark. So, you know, and he doesn't hear him jerking things around frantically, trying to figure out what's going on. You would expect a little more from this. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
Now, I want to take a little bit of a diversion here and go back to the original script, which deals with this escape by plane, which is much shorter in the original script. It flows completely through. They don't give us even, you know, we don't get Hiltz in the middle of it. So basically they take off and he adjusts. That's the first thing he does. And then says, next stop, Switzerland. And immediately after that, it says the motor coughs. Henley frowns, adjusts the throttle. It coughs again. The valley has begun to narrow. Henley barely maintains it as the engine continues to lose power. Meaning that as soon as they take off, this happens. This isn't, they don't have to wait to get to the Sleeping Beauty castle for this to happen. Henley says, well, I'm not getting fuel. Frantically checks the controls. And he goes, got to be a booster pump somewhere. And then engine cough and it sputters. And then Henley says to Blythe, do you know the German word for pump or booster or fuel? Blythe's response is no. And then it says, Henley locates a lever, puts Blythe's hand on it. And then he says, God knows what this is, but pump it like hell. And then the engine dies. And then he goes, never mind, just hang on. Again, I'm very glad they cut that out. It's hilarious.
It doesn't sound. No, I think the way they staged it is much superior in the film, because it teases us, the audience, with the idea, they could actually get away. They're nearly home. They nearly have escaped. And there isn't nearly the suspense in the version that you described as the one that we get actually on screen in the film.
Yeah, but the version there is again further proof that Henley doesn't know how to fly.
So yeah, I mean it's.
Maybe we should do like a poll. Do people think that Henley is really an RAF pilot or not?
Yeah, has he just seen somebody's uniform in the hope of getting some better food and some better accommodation?
And maybe he's not really even a scrounger. He just pretends.
Yeah, he's just
he's paying someone else cigarettes to get all the stuff for him.
It's not beyond the realms of possibility. I think at this stage of proceedings.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we're back to where we were talking. Then we get to see the plane beginning once again to continue descending. And then we get a shot inside the cockpit. And then we get Henley doing the Frank Costanza move. Do you know what the Frank Costanza move is?
No, you're going to have to enlighten me.
So there's an episode of Seinfeld called The Understudy, which deals with a part where the whole idea of stopping short. So Frank Costanza mentions to Kramer that he's, how dare he stop short with my wife? Basically, the idea is that when you stop short,
right,
you throw your right hand across the passenger, and instead of just trying to help them, from flying forward, you also, for lack of a better phrase, cop a field. And the way that Henley Gardner does, it looks exactly like that's what he's doing here. And it's just hilarious to think about it. Again, this reference is from 30 years later, 30 plus years later. Trying to remember when that episode aired. We're talking at least 30 years.
Well, Henley's character is a...
So Henley originated...
Yeah, he's a bit of a smooth talker. He's a bit of a smooth operator. So it's probably not within the realms of possibility that he's done this move, on a few ladies when he's been, in a car. So maybe, as you say, maybe he's the originator of this particular move.
Could be. I mean, Frank does mention that he did it in 1955. This movie takes place 11 years earlier. You never really know.
My mind's melting with the chronos.
Well, that's because, you have to deal with time travel with these type of things. The backwards and forward asset all. What came first? You never know. He tries to shield Blythe. So the episode aired on the 18th of May, 1995. So we're talking 32 years later. There we go. Now we know that. Okay, so So Frank says he started in 1955, which is 40 years earlier than 1995. But Henley and Blythe are flying in 1944, 11 years earlier. But the film only came out in 1963, which is 19 years later. So, you know, try to grasp all that, everyone.
Yeah, I think it'd be easier trying to understand Tenet than trying to work that one out.
Possibly. But then we get a shot of the plane landing on the ground. He actually does a really good landing job here, considering the plane is having a lot of trouble. The plane doesn't crash land. It actually lands on its three wheels. And I guess the problem here is, just, once again, goes back to the fact that Henley is not a pilot. He doesn't know where the brakes are. He knows how to land it, but doesn't know how to stop it.
Yeah, so for a few brief seconds, we're back on Henley being a good pilot, and then later it's like, oh no, change your mind. He doesn't know what he's doing. So I mean, it's a seesaw. It's a roller coaster with the whole, you know, Henley as a pilot debate.
Yeah,
but sure. This particular moment, I thought there was a superb edit here by Sturgis and by, you know, the editor that he was working on this film, because I thought that the transition from the plane being in flight to the ending is really cleverly done. And it's only if you watch it closely, as obviously we are, because we're watching this film, you know, minute by minute, second by second, you can see that clearly the plane, it never actually lands. When it's running along the ground, it's already on the ground. But such is the cut between the two shots, your mind just sort of fills in the blank, and you almost sort of, oh yeah, I saw it touch down and hit the ground, but it never actually does. It's just a great bit of editing there to join those two bits of plane being in flight to plane just round, to join those together and just create that illusion.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this movie was edited by Ferris Webster, who actually received only an Oscar nomination for this movie, for editing.
Ah.
He lost. And this was the third time that he lost. He was also nominated the year before for editing The Manchurian Candidate, and in 1955 for editing Blackboard Jungle. So, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, some great pedigree there, for sure.
But as great of an editor he was, he still didn't manage to win. What can I tell you? This movie is edited beautifully. There's no question about it. Obviously, it's a point to me that it only got editing. It only got an editing nomination, regardless of that, or irregardless of that. You know, it deserved more, but this one was for sure deserving. There's no question about it.
Yeah, do you know what others, you know, up for nominations in when this film would have been, you know, possibly in the running, well, was in the running for some of the awards?
I don't know the answer to that. Wait, hit me, in what category? In what category do you want to know?
Well, let's do the sort of like the obvious. What was Best Picture, for that year? So I guess it would be 63.
It was 1963. Yeah. Best Picture, the winner is actually one of my favorite Oscar-winning movies, Tom Jones. I'm just not a fan of that movie at all.
Can't say I've seen it.
Okay. The other films that were nominated were America, America, which was Ilya Kazan movie, Cleopatra, you know, with
Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
The West Was Born, which was another great ensemble film from that year. Not as good as this one, but still nicely done. And The Field, which is the movie that Sidney Poitier won.
Sidney Poitier,
Right. So,
we've been talking about the score all week. Do you know what in the kind of best original score or whatever they call it, what category, what was up for award?
Again, you think I don't know the answer to that?
I know you do.
I'm a big Oscar fan. That's first of all. And second of all, when dealing with the Great Escape, it's always a sore point for me. So they had two scoring categories. That the first one was substantially original, which basically means mostly original. the five films.
Not plagiarized.
Exactly. No, but just wait. Hear the name of the second one. So the five nominees that year were Tom Jones, 55 Days of Peking, Cleopatra, How the West Was Won, and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And I know that they all do have nice scores, but none of them are better than what we have here, in my opinion.
I mean, if you asked somebody to you know, if you gave them those five films and The Great Escape and you said, can you whistle the theme tune to one of these? I think people would only, you know, give you a rendition of the music from one film, and it's the one we're talking about.
You don't even need to ask them if they can whistle it. If you ask them if it's the, which one of them can they identify?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And the second category of scoring is best music scoring of music adaptation or treatment.
Mouthful.
There's nothing original this year. Maybe that's why it didn't get nominated, because there was no category for original score. There was substantially original and adaptation or treatment.
Well, I mean, yeah.
That's just absurd.
I mean, the Oscars are often not a barometer of the best film. They're often a sort of barometer of, you know, how much industry lobbying on behind the scenes. And, you know, something like Cleopatra, I mean, that's a pretty... It's not a good film, but the number of Oscar nominations that got, you know, are more to do with the industry trying to salvage the prestige of that noted, you know, studio bankrupting movie than probably the actual merits of the film.
Yes.
And it seems that, I mean, but you know, just on a purely meritocratic basis, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that all of those films that you've listed in those various categories don't deserve to be there, but The Great Escape, I find it, you know, if you've got things like How the West Was Won, you know, being floated around as one of the sort of, you know, as an Oscar worthy film, how The Great Escape is not in some of those more you know, sort of prestigious categories is really baffling.
Exactly. I do the same thing myself. Now, in contrast, for the Golden Globes that year, okay, it got one nomination also for Best Picture.
Right.
And that was the only thing it was nominated for.
It's the Best Picture, but you know, none of the acting, none of the directing, the cinematography, none of that was worthy of mention. But the film was really good. So I mean, yeah, how you can get a nomination in that category, but in nothing. Yeah. That's a positive.
And it was nominated as a drama also.
Oh, okay.
What was the name of that movie with The Cardinal, which was an Otto Preminger movie?
Oh, yes.
It was interesting. Again, to me, there's no better movie from 1963 than this movie. So, you know, there's nothing that I would say is a better movie from that year. But it has a lot to do with the fact that this movie is just so enjoyable to watch. It's so much fun by the way that they do it. And it's got a story, great message, great characters, you know, everything all wrapped into one. But...
Well, there are more good movies that have been ignored by the Oscars than there are films than there are good films that have been rewarded by the Oscars. So
yes, for sure.
The Great Escape's got some it's in some cunny in the fact it's been overlooked in that way.
Yes, for sure. But most of the movies that we think of that got ignored by the Oscars were nominated and didn't win. You know, as opposed to this didn't get any nominations or whatever. This was completely left on. But that's neither here nor there, since neither of us gets to vote. It doesn't make a difference. So moving on into this minute, we still have half a minute to go. And the plane, as you said, you know, glides in nicely, lands nicely, and can't stop, and crashes into the trees at the end of the field. And they do a nice job of tearing those off of the plane as it goes through. You got some pretty strong trees that are able
to... Yeah, it's a good bit of stunt work there, because there obviously must have been somebody in that cockpit driving that, they're not really flying anymore, so I guess they're driving that plane into those trees. And yeah, they've rigged up that aircraft very well to kind of give it a good death as it hits those trees.
Yeah, there's absolutely no question about that. The way they do that is done really, really well. And also the symmetry of the way that those wings just fly off at the same time. You know, Henley was able to get it perfectly right in the center of those trees. Maybe he was hoping, well, actually, it makes sense. He'd rather that the wings get clipped than for them going right into the tree.
For sure.
So here we go, another point for him being a good pilot.
I would love. We'll slop at the end of this episode.
Well, I haven't been keeping score of you. And then we get a shot inside the cockpit, which is great because we see the two of them. You know, apparently they weren't wearing seatbelts. Henley's face is in the dashboard, and Blythe is looking. He's just grabbing his head, trying to figure out what's going on. You know, we see Henley pulls his head back, and you see a large gash with fake blood on his face. And then he looks out and sees that the engine is on fire. So, and I love the way he gets out of the plane. He opens the door and just falls right out. And he falls gracefully, as they say. And there's tons of smoke that comes out. You know, they plan this really well. That, you know, you open up the cockpit window and all of this smoke comes out. But again, he falls and he hits his leg as he's falling down. And then once again, we're going to go back to the fact that, you know, Blythe is blind, but he's still able to get out of the plane successfully. Or exit of the plane, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Because Henley does stand up to pull him out completely. You know, we get Colin half jumping out of the plane, carrying him out, which is...
Yeah, he navigates that a little bit too adeptly.
Yes, a little bit too. But I commend Henley on the fact that he could actually lift up Colin. You know, he's holding him up, even for a few seconds. Not many people could probably do that. maybe it's because maybe it's adrenaline. Maybe it's, you know, his superhuman powers that are now, you know, his X-gene was just activated as by all the adrenaline pumping of crashing the plane. Who knows? You know, again, we were talking about fan fiction about his history up until now. We can actually now do fan fiction of history afterwards of him becoming a superhero.
Yeah, very possibly. I mean, I think of those, from adrenaline to X-gene, I think I'm probably going to go with it, adrenaline. I don't think it's probably not quite enough evidence in the film to think that, he should be, in the X-Men franchise. But, they're all about, all these studios love exploiting their intellectual property. So, you know, maybe there'll be some sort of... after we finished de-aging James Garner in this great equal, they'll shove him into the X-Men franchise.
Yeah, maybe. You never know. And then we get Colin coughing, and both of them look completely which is great. But I think they're overacting here a little bit. You see the way that Henley looks back, and he like waves his arms frantically back and forth. You know,
well, the disorientation does sort of play into sort of what happens in a few seconds' time.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Well, we're only going to find that out on Monday. But
Spoilers here. No spoilers
you're not
here.
Know. you'll never know.
I know nothing about. Yeah, sorry. I apologize. I know nothing about what happened after this moment.
And then he basically pulls him up. Henley pulls up Colin, and he just points and goes, "Go that way. I'll follow." Again, telling one person, go that way. And then pushing him off. He gives him a nice little push. You know, on your way.
Yeah, get going, you bastard. Go that way. Yeah.
Which makes you wonder why he's doing this. I mean, you don't see, at this point, any Germans around or anything like that. Like, why is he pushing him away?
No,
because the plane's about to explode?
Yeah, exactly. And he goes the opposite direction. So I just don't know what that's about. It's not like he's sort of like worried that the whole thing might blow up and he just wants to get him away to safety whilst he, I don't know, grabs something from the cockpit, you know, the rifle or something. You know, he then just sort of scarpers in the other direction. Yeah. So it's a bit of a mystery. Maybe he's just absolutely sick of him by now. He's just like, you know what, like the game's up. I'm never getting out of Germany with Blythe in tow. I'll just send him that way. I'll catch up whilst I hot foot it in the other direction. So maybe this is the cynical scrounger side of Hend coming out again.
It's very possible. But I love the way that he pushes him. He says go that way, and then gives him a really hard shove. And you see that the momentum of that shove is what takes him along the way. Mm. And then he nicely bumps and falls when he hits a small hill. You know, showing once again that he is blind.
I mean, Donald Pleasance must have been black and blue by the time he finished scenes with James Garner, the way he's just been, you know, manhandled around through the last 5 minutes that we've been reviewing.
Yeah, exactly. Because he really gives him a hard shove if you look at it. And then he hits the starts crawling up it, and then stands up. And again, he has no idea where he's going. He can't see. So he should have waited there.
Yeah.
And then he stumbles along a little bit and be a nice countryside.
It's at the moments like this you really want to be able to talk directly to the characters in a film and just sort of
stop. Don't go any further.
Stay away from that propeller.
There you go. No, that might have been a little easier for him. it might have been a better compensating way for him to have gone.
But I did, my filmic interest is primarily exploding helicopters. And you did say, sorry, I'm inviting you to be on The Great Escape. There won't be any exploding helicopters here. But, the way things have worked out, I have basically got to see an exploding airplane here.
Is
so
exploding?
Well, I mean, look. These are thin times, watching The Great Escape is a thin time for an exploding helicopter fan. So I'll take what I can get. So another form of aviation transport, crashing and being on fire, I'll take that, in a drought, you'll take any kind of, any type of cup of water. So, I'll take that. But, just... random bit of fact for just to tie in this particular scene and my particular interest is that Donald Pleasance in all the exploding helicopter films Donald Pleasance is quite an important actor because he's equal second in terms of the actor who's appeared in the most films with an exploding helicopter in them. So he's been in 9 films
wow.
which feature an exploding helicopter, which puts equal with Arnold Schwarzenegger and B-list action star Gary Daniels. So...
wow.
He's got a way to go. If he wants to be number one, he's got a little way to go. He's got to catch up with Dolph Lundgren and Samuel Jackson, who have been in 11 films. But Donald Pleasance did appear in a lot of B-movie action, B-movie sci-fi films in the 70s and 80s. So, I'm sure there are some unknown Donald Pleasance exploding helicopter films out there. So, he could be in the running for being, the most important star of my favorite invented micro-genre.
Ooh, you now have your work ahead of you to start checking out some of those Donald Pleasance
Some of those
movies,
yeah.
Wow, that is actually fascinating. I'm actually surprised Schwarzenegger isn't number one on that. I would have thought that he's been in the most... I bow to your knowledge on this subject.
He just doesn't make enough films. So, Samuel Jackson is a very prolific actor. So that's, I think, largely what lies behind the fact that he's got 11. And, Dolph, similarly, he's cranking out sort of probably about three, B-movie action films a year. So that's what kind of, if you want to be one of the top boys, that kind of is what kind of gets you towards the top of these lists. And that's obviously why Donald Pleasance is in that company, is because of his years in I don't know what you call it, low budget filmmaking, exploitation cinema, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, but he was in 7 movies.
He was indeed, yeah.
That's just, yeah. And wait, do you count TV movies also, or just...
I include TV movies, yeah.
Okay, so, then you have a lot more credits to add there. I mean, I don't know how many of them are movies and how many of them are TV series, but he has 102 TV acting credits, so, he's got a nice bit to choose from. I hope you take a bunch and start checking it out. Now, Samuel L. Jackson's only been in 133 movies, so he's got his way to try to catch up.
Yeah.
But he's still alive, so...
Well, he's joint number one with Dolph Lundgren, so, yeah.
No, I know that. I'm saying he might surpass him with the number of movies he's been in.
Right, yeah. Oh, for sure. I would say that's almost bound to happen.
So I never asked you, what's your history with this movie?
So, great. I mean, it's a film that I've seen many, many times. I don't know what's... I'm based in the UK, and... Here, this film is a bit of a sort of cultural intuition. So it's a film that, for whatever reason, you know, there are certain in the UK, we have, you know, sort of six or seven bank holidays over the course of the year. And for whatever reason, TV programmers always seem to put on one of a handful of films, you know, on a bank holiday. And for whatever reason, The Greatest is sort of one of these bank holiday movies. So you can pretty much guarantee that when one of these public holidays rolls round, the Great Escape will be sort of scheduled on TV at some point. So it's a film I've seen many, many times. And it is a film that, through lines of dialogue, the line that happens right at the end, you know, good luck to Gordon Jackson's character at the end. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the motorcycle jump, the theme, there are so many sort of iconic moments in this film that are just sort of cultural sort of touchstones. So yeah, it's a film that, you know, you almost can't sort of grow up in certainly when I was growing up, it was a film that just was sort of always around you sort of culturally. And the reason I'm here is because it is a great movie. It's just got incredible cast, great score, it's telling a really interesting, fascinating story. It's brilliantly directed by John. So yeah, it's a film that I have loved for many years, and always enjoy going back and rewatching it.
All right, very cool. Now, I mean, you mentioned the whole bank holiday aspect of it. There were actually a few potential guests that I turned to from England, and they told me absolutely not, because of the fact that they've seen this movie so many times and they're just sick of it and don't want to talk about it anymore. But that happens. What can you do?
Well, there you go. It's just evidence, though, of the fact that it has, does come up on the, all the time. It's just one of these sort of like bank holiday, I don't know, something about like a very long war epic that TV programmers think, yep, that's absolutely right for this bank holiday off. I'd love to understand the psychology of it better, but
I don't know, we don't have to understand it, just just enjoy it.
Exactly.
Do you want to tell people how to get in touch with you?
Sure. Well, if I've whetted your appetite for the weird world of films with exploding helicopters, then yeah, come and check out my website, explodinghelicopter.com. We've got loads of reviews where helicopters explode. We're also a podcast. You can find us on all good and moderate podcasting apps. Just look for Exploder. And if you want to come and say hello to me on social media, I am mostly on Twitter, and you can find me as Chopper Fireball.
All right. Excellent. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler. And our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. Will, thank you very much. This was a very fun week. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did.
No, it's a real pleasure to come and chat with you about such a great movie.
Yeah, and hopefully our listeners also enjoyed listening to this week.
Fingers crossed.
Exactly. So everyone have a great weekend, and we'll see you on Monday with a new guest. And until then, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
Everyone, because we're winding down and we have less than 30 episodes left, I decided I'm going to do something very special for the final episode of this podcast. If anyone can please send us any questions, we're going to do a Q&A section, me and one or two other guests. So if you have any questions about The Great Escape, or about doing a Movies by Minute podcast, or about me, or anything that you want to ask, it doesn't make a difference. You can ask us questions. And once we record episode 172, we will answer all of your questions, get them to us as quickly as possible. You know where to send them, as a private message to Facebook, to Twitter, or you can send them to email any which way that we can see the questions and no one else will see them, and we will answer them live for you. Thanks a lot, everyone.